Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, we'll talk about the best organic gardening methods on How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and international expert agro-homeopath Avi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with co-host Kavi Raj, the author of the international best-selling book, Homeopathy for Farm and Garden. Today is November 17th, 2010, and you're listening to show number 5 of How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. We have a great lineup of conversation. We're going to recap the GMO foods and talk about the seasonal garden. And then we're going to talk specifically about rice and the rice paddies. And we tested some new music today. It seems it turned up to be quite loud and perhaps not as favorable. We'll see if we can make an adjustment on that. Also, we're going to talk a little bit. Kavi is with us today. And like to welcome him. Kavi Raj, I want to welcome you today, and we'll get started a little bit on the recap for GMO foods.
Okay, thank you very much, Debbie.
Okay, that's great. I just wanted to test that you could hear me. All right.
Yes, I can hear you pretty well.
Great. So, talking about the GMO foods, there is a wonderful website called avaaz.org, avaaz.org. And there it has a special place, like a petition, where you can vote. They wanted 1 million votes for GM facts, not crops. The European Commission, which had recently approved growing genetically modified crops for the first time in 12 years, was putting the GM lobby's profits over public concerns, they say. 60% of Europeans feel that we need more information before growing foods that could threaten our health and our environment. There's a new initiative that allows 1 million European citizens a unique chance to make official requests of the European Commission. And they wanted to build 1 million voices for the ban of GM foods until the research is completed. So there is that petition there at avaaz.org. And to tell you the truth, what's happened is they've overreached their need for a million votes. They've got 1,213,257,000 votes on that petition at this time. And that was the million votes was reached in September. If you go to the website, you will see the location where people are signing up and putting their petition, and it tells you minute by minute. It's live, and you can see people from France, from England, from all different countries signing this petition. It's pretty neat to see that going on. And what else do we want to tell you about the GMO foods today? Anything else in particular? Because we talked about it at length at the last show about what Monsanto was doing, and we'll continue to give little tidbits about genetically modified foods in each show and reasons why we need to be cautious and take care before implementing it in our environment, or actually now, since it's all prolific, what we can do to reduce the intake and continued spread of the GMO foods. Do you have any comments about that for today?
Can
you hear?
The thing is,
okay.
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me too?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to turn your sound up a little bit.
Well, I have turned it maximum, so I can't get any louder.
Okay, so it might be on my end. All right, good. Okay, good.
Yes. I think this whole thing with Avaaz is actually fantastic. I have signed myself. I have called upon all my Facebook friends to sign. And I said, okay, let this go viral. Yeah?
Okay.
We need more signatures than we really need. We just want more. And so people kept going for it. And I'm very happy with the result, because that means that now there is a ban on growing them in Europe, which France already had, and which Germany only allowed on certain plots for tests, and even that now seems to have been frozen. Yeah, they first have to give us the proper science, and then we can think about it. But since the proper science cannot be presented, it has been debunked by Apa Pustai as the first one, and so many others, that actually GMOs are bad for your health. They had given them to rats, and the rats produced offspring which weighed only half of what the normal offspring would, and they would not grow to full maturity. They would die before that. So the science is not really there to back it up, and in this way we can keep that out of Europe. And I actually, I am sorry that you Americans have to live with all this stuff.
Right. The Americans are a little bit behind the times. The basic thing, the message that we want to send out to the public is to inform your friends, your neighbors, your family members, let other people know what it means to be eating GMO foods, and the fact that it is not labeled such, so that you do not know what is in the products that you're putting into your body. And so basically our message from Homeopathy World Community and Blog Talk Radio is to educate the people. And since we're already dealing with it, we're going to have to learn ways of reducing the amount of GMO foods. Basically, in our family, in our personal lives, we have to make the choice. And you choose basically by going and purchasing products, organic products and local products. And that's a really good way to start.
Do
you have any other hint?
Yes, it is. At the moment, is a petition going against Kellogg. Right now, people are voting for Kellogg, who says they have GMOs in their products, and they say they are safe. And so the petition is going to Kellogg that if you don't take it out, we won't buy your food anymore.
Okay, so those are the ways take action.
Yes.
Right? By your pocketbook. What you buy is a statement of how you feel.
Yes.
Okay. I'm also going to put up on the blog something really cute that I found. It's we've been talking about infestations of insects, and there's a cute kind of spoof about bugs taking over a person's house. And I'm going to share that with you. I can't share it with you on the radio show, but because it's a video, but I can put it on the blog. And we wanted to go ahead and talk about what's happening seasonally in our gardens a little bit. And my question, Kavi, is, am I planting something in my garden now? I'm looking out my window and I see – The crepe myrtles have turned a golden brown hue with specks of red, and we have cooler nights, and the days are not so bad. It's probably what I call sweater weather, and I expect it to get a little bit colder because we're having a late winter. Am I planting anything in the garden right now?
Yes, you will be planting anything. It will be winter cabbage. It will be winter grains and maybe some root vegetables. But I would leave them for the spring because the most root vegetables, like carrots and beets, they need 2 years to fully grow.
Okay, so I'm not really planting. I'm just overwintering by mulching and covering up the tender plants that are in the garden, something like that.
Yes, you could protect your tender plants by putting a layer of straw around them because that insulates them against the cold. And as I said, if you plant anything, it is winter cabbages. Yeah, like the head cabbage, the big green cabbage, the big white cabbage, they can be planted for the winter because they grow in the winter.
Including something like, will kale or any of those other cucurbits grow in the cabbage family?
Kale might do it, yes. Usually kale is planted in spring, and then in the winter, we say the kale tastes best after there has been a frost over it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And that's what we say here in Europe. Kale needs a frost to have a good taste.
That means it needs to be already planted in the garden.
Yes.
So is it in autumn? Okay.
No, that is something you plant in the spring, and by autumn it's grown nice, these big frilly leaves, and then here in Europe we say okay, now a night frost, and then we have the best taste.
Mhm. Okay, and when I plant my cabbage, do I get sets, or am I planting seeds, or how am I planting it?
You can plant it as a seedling, which you can actually buy at the nurseries. You can buy cabbage seedlings. You plant them straight into the ground. That is always well before the frost, yeah. And you give them a nice dose of silica to survive, yeah. And then see how they go. Now the thing is that after planting them, best is first to give some calendula, and then a couple of days later you give them silica. Because if you give them silica straight away, as Mark Moody and I have noticed the last time when I was having a seminar at his place, they had just planted some kale and we gave it silica. And the ones that we had given calendula and water, they stood nicely upright. And the one we had given silica, that took 3-4 days before they finally lifted themselves up off the soil. So silica is not good to give immediately after the transplant, but it is very good once they have established themselves.
Okay, so that's important information. And we typically think about calendula as something for wound healing, something to heal the skin. And it's interesting.
When you plant a little seedling, you make a hole in the ground, you stick it in there, and then make the sand a bit firm around the roots. And I think there may be some damage to the roots because they are very fine hair roots, and they get a little bit damaged. And so therefore, if you give them calendula, very quickly they perk up and say thank you, in that way. Whereas when you don't do that, you can give them some water, but then it takes 1 or 2 days before they get up. And if you give them silica, usually it takes 3-4 days for them to get up. So the best is always calendula after the transplant.
Okay,
Yes.
Okay, so you're saying for the shock of transplant, really is what it is. And the other remedies that I typically think about would be, if you're talking about roots, are similar, comparable to nerves, I think about Hypericum as something to deal with.
Yes, but cleanse of non-nervous system, and remedies that work mainly on the nervous system have very little or no action on plants, I have noticed. Like Nux vomica does practically nothing for the plant. Rustox does practically nothing for the plant, because they are mainly nerve remedies. They have a strong influence on our nervous system, yeah, and they do very little about it. The only time that Nux vomica does something is when you have poisoned your plants with agricultural chemicals, and then Nux is good. But for any other thing, Nux vomica, don't give it to plants.
Okay. That is really good information. And what about the other remedy that I think about for shock is aconite and arnica. Those two are the top ones that we typically think of if there's been any kind of accident, or even cold shock for aconite or cold wind.
Cold shock for aconite is a good idea. Yes, cold shock for aconite is a good idea. And if plants suffer from frost, then another good idea is to give them remedies that we normally use for chilblains.
Like agaricus?
You know, like agaricus, okay. you can do that. And there are some more. I'll have a look in the repertory right now and look at chilblains, mm-hmm. if there is any remedies that speak about that. Because I haven't looked at that. I should have actually done that. Chilblains. Okay, one moment, please. Yeah?
Okay, he's looking up in the repertory. Homeopaths use a book called The Repertory, which gives listings of symptoms and appropriate similar remedies that will help to alleviate those particular symptoms. And then there is the Materia Medica, right? So we want to introduce this information to those who have just started their journey to homeopathy. And there is the Materia Medica, which is similar to like an encyclopedia. It tells you the name of the remedy and everything having to do with that remedy and all of its properties and what symptoms are elicited
There's also a repertory in the back of my plant book where it talks about the different diseases and the different pests. And in the back you find the repertory, this pest and that remedy or those remedies. And here for chilblains it also says abrocanum. And it gives us also calendula and cantharis. Yeah. And this is nitric acid and petroleum. Yeah, and nitric acid especially is important because that has to do with the nutrients as well. And there is Pulsatilla. Yeah,
and which one?
Sulfur is another nutrient. Pulsatilla.
Oh, Pulsatilla for chilblains.
Yes, and
because they like to be sulfur.
Yes, they like that. Yes, sulfur also. Okay. And sulfur is another nutrient that we use in agro-homeopathy, and which is actually quite important, although it is a micronutrient. Actually, when we look at the nutrients for plants and the remedies that we use for that, then we find that the micronutrients are more important than the macronutrients, because if they have a lack or an excess of a micronutrient, the symptoms are much more severe.
And is it similar in humans too? I mean, if we're missing zinc or copper, or I would consider them, these are micronutrients in the human body, we can elicit symptoms that would not be very pleasant to live through. So the plants, we are so similar to plants, people don't recognize how that is true. I mean, they need sunshine, we need sunshine, water, good soil, a nice soft bed, and just comfort and friends and people who are in our neighborhood, and plants need companion planting. There are a lot of similar ways that we can talk about plants and humans.
Yes, exactly. And like, for instance, in humans, if you look at cancer patients, all cancer patients have a magnesium deficiency.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, so,
they have a magnesium deficiency.
Yes, always. And if you give them magnesium, then they can fight the cancer a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. That supports their system. So is that considered a micronutrient?
System.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So therefore, cancers also are found in trees. And
right.
If you then have an analysis of the soil around the trees, you find very often there is a deficiency in magnesium in that soil. And if you give magnesium to the tree, it can fight off the cancer much easier.
Interesting. Fascinating.
Yes.
We are so similar, and if we would examine our plants around us and the things that they need to stay well, we would learn a little bit about what we need to stay well. And isn't there a particular balance between magnesium and calcium or other minerals that we need to
keep? If you have a cancer patient and he has too much calcium, then the cancer grows bigger. Yeah, so the calcium
mm-hmm.
and the magnesium balance has to be very nice. Yeah. Too much
mm-hmm.
calcium is not a good thing, because then calcium calcifies things, makes them harder. Yeah. And so
mm-hmm.
When things become too hard, they become brittle. And in the same way,
right.
in plants, if you do overliming, as it is called, that means that you put too much calcium on the soil, then the plants also go brittle and they break off very easily. Yeah, so that's why we want a neutral acidity, a neutral pH, as it is called. Yeah, and the neutral
right.
pH is around 7.8. That is neutral. Yes. And if it is lower, the scale is logarithmic, so the lower the scale, the greater the acidity. The higher the scale, the greater the alkalinity. If it is too alkaline, the plants grow brittle and fall over very easily. Yeah, so
mm-hmm.
For the plants, we seek a neutral pH that is the best soil for them to grow in, although there are plenty of soils that like acid. And there are plenty of soils.
Yes,
in
my
alkaline.
Area, they like acid. The pine trees produce an acid soil, so naturally the plants like azaleas that grow and rhododendrons that grow in the natural wild areas, they do like to have that acid. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that is correct. Actually,
pines
will only grow where the soil already is acidic. The pine is actually a pioneer plant that will change the soil by taking all the acid out. Yeah, and then it makes the soil more neutral. Just like you have sorrel, sheep sorrel. Sheep sorrel only grows on acidic soil, and it is what is called a pioneer plant that will change the structure and the acidity of the soil and make it ready for other plants to come in. And you will see after some years, when plants grow on acidic soils, the soil becomes more alkaline, and other plants are coming in, and then the biome will change.
Yes.
So many people may not understand.
You kind of explained what a pioneer plant is, and that is the one that comes in first.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A pioneer plant is a plant that comes in first in a particular soil type. And prepares the soil by taking out its acidity or by taking out its alkalinity, by changing the alkalinity to more neutral. It helps prepare the soil for other plants that will come later, and then you get more biological variety.
Mm-hmm. So this is really important information, because we're talking about preparing our earth and our gardens for the different seasons that are coming up, and people might be overgrowing like legumes or something so that there's soil-fixing bacteria. So this is a way that we as gardeners can be pioneers to our gardens and enrich the soil by adding particular crops to overwinter. I don't know if there's – what are the other plants besides the legumes? Do you know what they are?
The legumes, they also grow pretty good in the winter. That is the beans that like black beans, red beans, white beans. They are also winter plants, and they actually fix nitrogen in the soil, because they make nodules in the roots that pick up the nitrogen and hold it there. So that when and by the time that you take them away, you cut them off above the ground, and you leave the nodules under the ground, and then they start rotting away, and they will release all the nitrogen for the crop that you plant after. Yeah, so mm-hmm. Everything is in relation to everything else. Everything follows each other. Like, for instance, on a sandy soil, if people have sandy soil and they don't know what to grow there, then grow buckwheat there, buckwheat. And if you grow buckwheat there,
I love buckwheat.
Yes. And if you grow buckwheat there,
so,
the soil will change and become ready for other things, especially if you leave the roots of the buckwheat in there.
Okay. The gardeners, they need to leave the roots. And does that mean that they just cut it off at the top, like mowing it, and they don't...
Yes,
They
should also leave the straw. You should also leave the straw. If a farmer, for instance, grows grains, like wheat, and he harvests everything, if he would leave the straw there, then the straw would stop the weeds from growing, and the straw would provide him with an enormous boost for cabbages, because cabbages like that kind of thing. Cabbages like to follow after different grains. Yeah, they love that kind of that kind of soil and the substances that are in the straw that are left in the soil are actually stimulus for the cabbage. Yeah, so then the farmer, if he leave that, he will get a much bigger cabbage harvest. But now, they take the straw off and they sell it. Yeah, but if they would put it back into the soil where it comes out of, they would get a better harvest next time, and they would have less fertilizer to buy. Farmers have been taught by the big agribusinesses to actually go against their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They are being told, okay, take the straw off and sell it, and you will make money. But he will make more money if he leaves it on there and gets a bigger harvest next time. But that's what they don't tell him.
This is a fantastic tip for those who don't realize that they have a gold mine in their straw. And that the straw, it's like an old fairy tale. there's a lot of things that people don't realize to improve their garden, and I appreciate that you're providing these tips and hints to them. I was thinking about overwinter crops of wheat, like hardy winter wheat, something like that. What are the other types of grains that are good for overwintering?
Well, there is wheat, there is rye, there is some barley types that grow good over winter. Yeah, and they are winter hardy. They can withstand the frost. And if you then in the spring take the grains away and leave the straw nicely on your soil, and you grow cabbages after, you grow huge cabbages. And actually, the farmers by selling it, they're killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. The straw, they have the goose that lays the golden eggs, and the big agribusinesses say sell it because they want to have the golden eggs. they want to sell the fertilizers.
It's a matter of education, I think, and letting them know what is the best way to manage their garden, their fields, their crops. I don't know how many small home gardeners grow any kind of field grain like that. Do you imagine? I guess we could. There's no reason why a small home garden gardener couldn't put them. So we're learning something here.
Yes.
And since we're talking...
If you take 100 grains, and you plant them, 100 wheat grains, so you have 100 wheat plants, and each of them has as an ear in which there are at least 100 grains again. Yeah, so you get 10,000 grains, and 100 grains is maybe, well, what shall it be, 25, 30 grams, and for 25, 30 grams, you get back 2.5 kilos. Yeah? So 25 grains produces for you 2.5 kilos. And if you do, say, 100 grams, you get it back 100-fold. 100 grams times 100 is how much? It's 10 kilos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's 10,000 grams.
Wow.
So that's 10 kilos. Yeah, so, 1 kilo of grains will give you 10 kilos of grains. Yeah, I mean, 1,000 seeds will give you 10 kilos of grains. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
beautiful.
That is worthwhile because 10 kilos of grains is, you grind it up and you make your flour with it. Well, with 10 kilos of flour, you can bake an enormous amount of bread.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so
therefore,
we need to.
Mm-hmm. So we can invest in our garden. You're teaching us the profits of planting. By investing a small amount, you get back so many tenfold. And now if I'm a home gardener. And I have to clip off the top. I'm getting too detailed here. We're going to probably save this for another time because I wouldn't know what to do with the plants. So let's save that for another time and move on to another type of crop that is people might have a question about, and that is rice. And it's a different kind of planting. Let me give a little bit of background. Rice is the second largest produced cereal in the world. At the beginning of the 1900s, the annual production was around 350 million tons, and by the end of the century, it had reached 410 million tons. World production totaled 395 million tons of milled rice, and that was in 2003, compared with 387 million tons in 2002, which means that it's going up pretty exponentially or going down. Let's see, from total 395 and going down to 387. Let's see where we have that. It said that the reduction since the end of the previous millennium is explained by the strong pressure put on land and water resources, which led to a decreased seeded areas in some Western and Eastern Asian countries. So I'm assuming that most of the rice plants are produced in the Asian countries. The production is concentrated in Western and Eastern Asia with more than 90% of the world output. China and India account for more than one-third of global population, 52.3% over the 1999 to 2003 period. They supply over half of the world's rice. Brazil is the most important non-Asian producer, followed by the United States, and Italy ranks first in Europe. I didn't realize that they planted rice in Italy.
Yes, so, you can plant rice. You can plant rice not only in paddies as they do in Asia. In Asia, they have the red rice planting, but you also have dry rice planting. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So you have varieties of rice that grow in dry soil.
Varieties that grow in dry soil. Okay,
yes,
so this is interesting.
Yes, so
instead of I think of them in water in swampy areas, and I was wondering if areas like, but that's briny water. Does the water have to be fresh water to grow?
It has to be fresh water, yes. Otherwise, it won't grow.
Fresh
Japan,
water.
For instance, grows a lot of dry rice. And there was Fukuoka who wrote his book, The One Straw Revolution. This is about rice growers because he noticed that the reduction in rice growing is actually because the people have abandoned the old ways of growing rice, which was to leave the straw in the field, again, as with the old farmers. Yeah? If you leave the straw in the field, you will suppress the weeds, and you will get a bigger rice crop. And rice is the only one that you can grow again and again and again in the same spot as long as you leave the straw in there. And the farmers have been told, no, get rid of the straw, you know, and put artificial fertilizer, and that has brought down the production. And so Fukuoka, with his book, The One Straw Revolution, he said, no, we don't have to do that. We have to do it like the old people did it. And so he started, and then he proved to the farmers that he had 30% more harvest than anybody growing with artificial fertilizers. And since that time, Japan has gone back to, for a great deal, to the old ways. And Japan has actually increased its rice production since that reduction. Yeah. In India, they're also selling the straw from the paddies. And in India, there was one man, he said, well, there is one guy, and his name is von Liebig. Yeah, he's a German. He was the one who came up with all the fertilizers in the beginning of the 19th century. And von Liebig's name is actually written, Lie Big. And he said, yes, and that's what it is. It's a big lie. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. We've really connected this importance of a simple straw and how important it is not only as bedding. There's many, many things that can be done with straw, but as protecting and covering up our tender plants with straw, and turning it back into the soil to bring some mulch and to tamp down the weeds and to keep a monoculture of rice, which is quite unusual that any one particular plant could survive having a monoculture without disease in the same area, because we didn't really talk about that theme in the past very much. We'll get to it in another show. And so straw, the simple lowly plant, plays a huge part in our garden, in all different kinds of gardens. And that's incredible. Let me talk a little bit more about this rice. I was looking up a little bit at world rice consumption. Increased 40% in the last 30 years, from 61.5 kilograms per capita to 85.9 kilograms per capita, which means that each individual is eating more rice, or the countries are eating, there's more population to feed. I'm not really sure how that figure comes about, and that there's three consumption models. The Asian model is that the average consumption is higher than 80 kilograms per person per year. Like in China, it's 90 kilograms. In Indonesia, it's 150 kilograms. Woo! They eat a lot of rice. And there's a PVD subtropical model where the average consumption is 30 to 60 kilograms per year, and that is, for instance, in Colombia, 40, and in Brazil, 45, in the Ivory Coast, 60. And then the Western model, that's, I guess, the United States, Canada, the average consumption is lower than 10 kilograms per year. Oh, and also France has, so that includes the Europeans maybe, There's 4 kilograms. Yeah. Can you compare that 150 kilograms of rice in Indonesia to 4 in France and 9 in the United States?
That is because in the United States and in France, it is not a staple food, but it's more a luxury that people do every now and then. They eat some rice.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Asia, it is the staple food, and people eat it every day. Yeah. So what you eat every day, it is a bit like wheat in the West. Yeah, wheat is not used so much in Asia as it is in the West, because we eat bread and we eat so many different things made with wheat. Yeah. Whereas in Asia, well, you know, you have the chapati and you have 2-3 chapatis with your food, and the chapati is very thin, unleavened bread. Yeah, it's like a pancake almost. Yeah, and they have two or three of them with their food. Yeah, and in Europe, everybody is eating massive amounts of bread with everything. Yeah, if you see that, for instance, the Italian and the French kitchen. Yeah. We eat hundreds of kilos of pasta, yeah, and that's all made from
pasta.
Meat.
Okay, yes. So now I want to know what is the healthier. First of all, I believe that brown rice is much healthier than white rice, and I don't know about probably whole wheat grain to make your wheat is much heartier and healthier, including all that fiber and nutrition, as opposed to flour that has been processed and either bleached or taken out all of the other components of the grain.
Well, in the West, we eat, of course, a lot of white bread, and that doesn't have much nutritional value. In the East, they eat a lot of white rice, but they don't polish it. It is unpolished rice, which is not really brown rice, because the hull of the brown rice is pretty undigestible for humans. Yeah, so they take the hull off, and that's it. They don't polish it. And that is the good rice. So it's not really full brown rice. It's not whole grain, yeah, but it is medium grain, so to speak. And whereas the white rice that goes for export that we eat, you know, the long grain Thai rice or the short grain sticky rice that we eat, is fully polished, and everything is being taken off.
I see. So I'm not educated about what that polishing process does to the rice. And are you telling me sticky rice is polished and that's not the best thing for me?
Exactly. Sticky rice is polished.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's actually what you're eating with sticky rice and all the white rices that you buy in the West is
starch.
Yeah, it's like white bread. It's starch. So you eat the starch, but starch is not a food. Starch is something to stick the wallpaper up the wall. Yeah, that's what we used to do. When I was a young kid, you buy these big buckets of dry starch, and you add water and you stir it up, and that becomes the glue with which you stick the wallpaper up the wall. Yeah.
Okay.
So, what do you use for your wallpaper? Would you stick that in your stomach and clog everything up there? And that is what causes arteriosclerosis and all these kind of things, because the starch is so fine that it penetrates the walls of the blood vessels. And that is really the biggest cause of arteriosclerosis. White grains, polished grains that are only starch. Starchy food.
Does it say it?
Pardon?
Does it say it on the label? Does it tell us on the label of the package that it's a polished grain, or we just have to know that? And also, we have a comment coming in. I'll give that to you in a minute. So, how do we know how do we know to distinguish in the store what we're purchasing?
Well, actually, if you get an unpolished grain and you look at it, then it has a shiny outer layer, and the polished grain is very dull to look at. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The shiny outer layer means that it is unpolished, and it has bran, and it has roughage, and it has proteins in it. Whereas the white grains that are polished, they look dull, to the eye.
It's kind of an, I don't know whether it's an oxymoron or it's a, like, whatever you want to call it. It's been polished, so it now looks dull. And as opposed to when you put a shine on something and you want it to be polished like your silver, it's reflective. And so they're using the word polished, which we think of as a nice glowing kind of thing. And it's kind of, they should call it unpolished or depolished or something else. But it's kind of funny.
Yeah, because they polish that thing off. You know, the grains go through a machine that takes off the bran and, you know, and that falls through, and that is what they give to your pigs and your cows. Yeah, so the best part of the food is given to the pigs and the cows, and you are fobbed off with a bit of starch.
So we're taking in too much starch, and we need to not do that and make a better selection in what we're putting into our bodies. And we can tell by looking at the grain itself. Okay, I was going to say a little bit more. Okay,
You had a question, you said.
Yeah, the question coming in is regarding sandy soil. Victor Kolasai is asking, how homeopathy helps in case of a soil that is sandy, which is not the best for the majority of growing greens. The only plant that I'm really familiar with on planting in sandy soil is asparagus. But I don't know which, maybe he can elaborate a little bit more on what types of greens or what kinds of plants he wants to grow and how we can prepare. How do you prepare a sandy soil?
Well, actually, you prepare that with silica, and when you give it silica, it will hold more water. And when it holds more water, you can grow many more different plants in there. And after you have harvested your plants and you leave the roots in there, that brings in the organic matter that will change the sandy soil to something that is more organically complete. And you can put a layer of compost on the top and add some worms, and the worms will bring it into the soil. In Australia, for instance, where I live, the soil was very sandy and the water would always run off. It would not even penetrate. So I started putting compost in there, and I started giving it silica, and it would retain a lot more water. And after about 1 year, I had 10 centimeters of sand left on the top, and the rest was all humus. Yeah, so that is how you change the soil to a different constituency by putting there straw. Straw is a good thing. Yeah, put straw. Straw is actually fantastic stuff. Every biota includes microorganisms and earthworms, and they have a special microclimate for their existence and activity in the soil. Yeah, and when decomposing the straw mulching, the biochemical process takes place on the proteins and the lignin from that combination. And that's not a political alliance. Yeah, the very important matter is created, lignoprotein. And by this lignoprotein. And by this protein, the numerous wide rootlets appear by which activities of the growth of crops or a fruit tree is gradually taking place. Yeah, and the important clay particles are created. Yeah, that is how clay particles are created. The new nitrogen are created, and the clay proteins are also created. And as a result, the texture and structure of the soil is extremely improved. And these colloids, they drag the moisture from the air and they store it in the soil.
Okay, Victor is following up with another question. He says, is water vital in this process? There are places where it is very dry and sunny, and there's probably many, you know, the desert, we think of the desert as being dry, sunny, and maybe sandy, but I also think of the beach as being very sandy, and it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, that silica, which is the main thing of sand, right? Is silica, we're giving silica itself. We're giving it back to itself.
Yes.
And
life
we also think
life.
Of
so if the problem is the sandy soil, you give silica. We did that in Australia over a piece as big as 100 hectares. We went there with a big spraying machine and we sprayed the whole thing. And 6 weeks later, we came back and we stuck the spade into the ground and the spade would come out wet. And in Australia, the rain never penetrates. It always runs off. But there, the water stayed under the soil. And when we came back, there were so many wildflowers and wild plants growing there. And then we started planting trees, you know. And by creating 100 hectares of trees, we created something that cooled down the air and made what we call a depression. And when there is a depression, rain is coming. Yeah, and so that piece of land started attracting more rain. And by doing that with anything where it is dry and hot, you will attract more moisture. Yeah, because the plants, all the plants that you plant, they evaporate the moisture and that goes in the air. And in the morning, during the dew, it is all collected back in. Yeah, because the dew always precipitates on the leaves and the leaves go completely wet. And then that drops on the soil and it penetrates the soil because you have given it silica. And the osmosis and the ionization of the sand particles have changed and now they can attract water instead of repel it. And then in this way, you together with the straw, you create a different kind of soil. And after a while, you don't have to you don't have to worry about it anymore because it will retain the moisture, as I just explained. If you put straw mulch is one of the best things to improve soil anywhere, as long as you add some worms that will bring it into the soil.
Okay, so we're adding another culture. So you just gave us the story of the water cycle, right?
Yes.
And then you're creating a total ecosystem. The soil, what you're going to be planting in, how you can enrich it with the straw, how you can add to it, how it will begin to grow more microorganisms and relationships within the soil, the plant, and now the water is being retained instead of having like you have a flood and the water just runs off the top and nothing seeps down in. So now using spraying or applying the homeopathic silica remedy, you're going to be able to improve this the relationships of all the components within the ecosystem and build a new ecosystem from a dry, arid area to a moist, green area. And this is really... greening our environment. It's incredible just with these simple steps.
That is greening of the desert. You see, because while decomposing a straw, proteins are split into amino acids and amides by the help of a protease mediator. Yeah, and then later these amino acids and amides are also split and ammonia is liberated. And ammonia is the main source for nitrogen. And nitrogen is the biggest nutrient for growth in plants. Yeah? And so microorganisms use those small quantities of amino acids and more ammonia to create in their body liquid materials. Yeah? And when these microbes die after decomposition of their bodies, then the released nitrogen is deposited into the soil and ultimately utilized by the roots of the plants that you have planted there. And that is how you create the nitrogen cycle, which is another very important one. Yeah, because the nitrogen cycle is the cycle of nutrients. We think about air and we think oxygen, but actually oxygen is only a small part in this. For 60% of this nitrogen. Yeah, nitrogen is the most important nutrient in this world. We breathe it, the plants breathe it, and everybody processes it. Yeah. And nitrogen is actually very, very, you know, the most important nutrient in the world. And the nitrogen cycle brings everything to a level where food crops can grow and where you can create a complete ecosystem and bring in rain where there never was any.
Incredible. And it's all up to us. That we have the potential to do that when we make good decisions and take note of what we're doing, take a conscious effort to employ this information and give to the soil. If we give and then we're going to receive, we're going to have a great harvest if we provide what's necessary to,
Mother Nature is very abundant. If you give her a little, she gives you a hundredfold back. Mother Nature is the best we can have. Yeah, and if we go against Mother Nature, she won't give us anything. Why would she? We don't give her something, so she don't give anything back.
So that's why we have an organic gardening show. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about, There's still, I could go into a little bit about international trade with the rice, but let's see, and importers, there's a lot people can look up. There was some more questions, a little bit more about rice and the kinds of weeds. We talked a lot about using straw to suppress weeds. And there was some more stuff that I was reading somewhere about other things. Let's see where that is, that information is.
There are a lot of allelo chemicals, which are weed suppressors.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you put the rice straw on the soil, the weeds will not come up. Yeah. It is a very simple process. Instead of buying expensive poisons to kill the weeds afterwards, if you just leave the straw, then you have a gold mine because you don't need to buy the fertilizer so much because there is fertility in the straw, as I have just explained with the nitrogen cycle, and there is no need to buy expensive poisons. You have clean food, you don't pollute the environment, and you reduce the dependence on fossil fuels because all these pesticides and herbicides and fungicides are made from fossil fuels. And so are the fertilizers. Yeah, so it is a win-win situation if you go organic. And all these people that say organic cannot feed the world, they don't know what they're talking about. They have no idea. If you go the other way and away from organic, then you will not be able to feed the world, because you will have to spend so much on fossil fuels and so much on pesticides and so much on fertilizer, and at some point the oil is going to run out, and then what are you going to do? What are they going
to
do?
It's true. We have to have a different viewpoint. I encourage everybody to continue to listen to Kaviraj in his wisdom about organic gardening, organic growing, sustainability of the earth and our air and our water. And the show is ending for today. I want to thank everyone who listens and who is downloading these shows and applying this really excellent information in how to improve our earth. I want to thank you, Kavi, again for another fantastic show. And so we're going to say goodbye for today.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody who has listened. And we will be seeing you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-hosts Kaviraj Vaidyanath and Debbie Brooks on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your gardens.